Now I should probably change it, but I'll live with it for a couple of minutes. I don't want to delay us. It looks good.
You know, I just wanted to say I'm impressed. I haven't figured that out yet on Zoom.
Oh, it's not hard. It's not hard, but it's kind of weird because you know half your head disappears and your eyes disappear, all that kind of weirdness. But it kind of looks good. People get tired of just staring at me after a while. Good afternoon, everybody. This is the Wednesday, September 30th, 2020. Session of the Portland City Council. Good afternoon, Keelan. If you could please call the roll for us.
Good afternoon. Hardesty?
Here.
Udaly?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Ryan?
Here.
Wheeler?
Here. Under Portland City Code and State Law, the City Council is holding this meeting electronically. All members of the Council are attending remotely by video and teleconference, and the City has made several avenues available for the public to listen to the audio broadcast of this meeting. The meeting is available to the public on the city's YouTube channel, eGovPDX, www.portlandoregon.gov/video, and of course, channel 30. The public can also provide written testimony to the council by emailing the council clerk at cctestimony@portlandoregon.gov. The Portland City Council is taking these steps as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, and we are encouraging the physical distancing in the best interest and the welfare of the public. We ask everybody for their patience and their understanding as we manage through this difficult COVID situation. And I'll now ask our legal counsel to please read us the rules of order and decorum.
Good afternoon. To participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the council clerk's office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions or the first readings of ordinances. The published council agenda at portlandoregon.gov/auditor contains information about how and when you may sign up for testimony while the City Council is holding electronic meetings. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you are a lobbyist, and if you are representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When your time is up, the presiding officer will ask you to conclude. Disruptive conduct such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being placed on hold or ejected from the remainder of the electronic meeting. Please be aware that all council meetings are recorded.
Thank you very much. We have two items in front of us today. The first is a resolution, item number 785, time certain 2 p.m.
Declare intent to initiate local improvement district formation proceedings to construct water main improvements in the Southwest Quail Post Road Local Improvement District.
Thank you. Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor. Today, we are conducting a resolution of intent hearing for the possible formation of a local improvement district, otherwise known as an LID, for Southwest Quail Post Road. And I'm initiating this LID because I believe it's the best option to support both the homeowners and the water system. The LID proposal would enable the private system to be replaced with a new public system for which the Water Bureau would assume maintenance responsibility after the LID is formed. I'm pleased that the Water Bureau, led by Engineering Supervisor Dave Ivanuk and LID Administrator Andrew Abbey, have presented a solution that can support Quail Park and allow the water system to be improved before it reaches the end of its useful life. This is a really unusual, the way we're doing this, for multiple reasons. One, the council is conducting a hearing to decide whether to initiate the possible formation. As in most of them, it comes from the homeowners. This was started by the homeowners asking the Water Bureau to help find a solution for their privately owned and aging system. And yet it's a different process, which Andrew Abbey will explain to us. Another reason it's a bit different is it's mostly focused on the water piping and system. Most of the local improvement districts that we deal with are about street improvements, with any stormwater and utility improvements secondary to the main purpose. But this is a different one, because street improvements are not the purpose of this LID. I actually could just remembered one other similar situation over the 12 years I've been on the council, in the Deltawood LID, which is over by Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in North Portland, on the peninsula. It's that was a low-income manufactured home park where we did something somewhat similar, and I think that's going to be discussed. This is an interesting one, colleagues, especially interesting. Not that LIDs are not always interesting, because I think they are. And so now I'm turning it over to Water Bureau Director Gabriel Solma to introduce our presenters.
Thank you so much, Commissioner Fritz. Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. My name is Gabrielle Selmer. I'm the Director of the Water Bureau. And as Commissioner Fritz introduced, today we are taking the first steps for a possible LID for Southwest Quail Post Road, the LID. This resolution is the first of three council items if the resolution is approved. An ordinance to form the LID would be considered in November, and a final assessment ordinance would be brought to council after the construction work is complete. The resolution would bring the Quail Park homeowner water system into compliance with the relevant safe drinking water standards. We've been in conversations with the stakeholders since June of last year, and as the commissioner mentioned, this is a slightly different process than we usually do for street LIDs. This LID is being council initiated at the discretion of Commissioner Fritz. So rather than an opt-in vote, there will be an opt-out vote if council did approve this resolution. And we appreciate the collaboration and thoughtful input from property owners, and we welcome their testimony today as to whether they support or do not support the LID proposal. All property owners have received multiple mailings on this project, a presentation, and months to ask questions. I'm really proud of the outreach work that our staff and that Andrew has done to make this opportunity available. And as you'll hear through the presentation, we believe that this is a win-win, and we request your vote to initiate LID formation. And now I'll turn it over to Dave and Andrew to walk you through the process.
Great. So my name is Dave Evanuk. I'm an engineering supervisor at the Water Bureau. I'll go ahead and share my screen, if that's okay. So hopefully everyone can see that. So I'll talk about some of the improvements that are being proposed as part of the local improvement district, and some of the risks that the LID will address. And then I'll pass it over to Andrew Abbey from PBOT to talk about the LID administration. This is a map that shows the project area in Southwest Portland. It's next to Huber Street and Lancaster Road. So Quail Park was, which is the area that's outlined and shaded in pink on the slide, was established in the 1970s. It currently receives its water from the Water Bureau on Southwest Ridge Drive through a 6-inch service line. The service line heads east to Quail Post Road, which is the main north-south road in the middle of this subdivision. And water is distributed through a network of privately owned pipes in private streets to each of the Quail Park properties. So assuming that the LID is approved, it's proposed that the Water Bureau would take over responsibility for water system maintenance at the time of the LID approval. At that time, the Water Bureau would also initiate a series of short-term phase one work tasks. So I'll just briefly describe what these tasks are. So one is setting up individual water accounts for each customer, installing new billing meters for each customer, constructing a new connection to the Portland water system at Southwest Huber Street, and that can be seen at the green dot at the bottom of the slide. And then also abandoning the 6-inch service line, which is shown by the red line extending from Ridge Drive. So those would be the short-term improvements if the LID is approved. And this map indicates the extent of the phase two improvements. So phase two improvements would be completed before the year 2039. And the reason for waiting to replace the system for that long is that it's estimated that the infrastructure has an average of about 20 years of remaining life on the system. So we wouldn't want to replace the infrastructure while it still has life remaining. So the long-term improvements include a new connection to the Portland water system at Southwest Lancaster Road. Includes replacement of all of the existing water system components. And after construction, it would include a one-time utility trench restoration and a full-width street overlay. After year 2039, when the phase two improvements are completed, the Water Bureau would continue to maintain the Quail Park water system and operate it as part of the larger Water Bureau system. So I'll talk about some of the risks that the LID would address. So one is that the existing service line to Quail Park does not have a backflow device, which is required under Oregon administrative rules. The backflow device protects the public water system, but it's not needed if Portland owns and operates what is now the private Quail Park system. Another risk is that the existing service line is difficult to access for maintenance as it passes beneath a creek. The creek crossing results in an increased environmental consequence if the service line were to fail by allowing chlorinated water to flow into the Tryon Creek watershed. Another risk is that there's only one water supply to Quail Park, the 6-inch service line from Ridge Drive. When the LID is complete, there will be two supplies to the area, and that will allow customers to remain in service during system maintenance when a portion of the system needs to be shut down. Another risk is that the entire Quail Park water system is approaching the end of its useful life. So as time goes on, failures and repairs are expected to become more numerous over time. It's our understanding that the Quail Park Homeowners Association does not have sufficient reserves at this time to replace significant portions of the water system if an unexpected failure were to occur. So this slide that's shown right now shows several aspects of a particular risk for a portion of the Quail Park system. So this picture was taken in 2019 when a portion of the piping of the system was exposed. And it shows the location where the service line, which is the line that's coming from the left of the screen, connects to the pipeline in Quail Post Road, which is oriented up and down. So the photo shows piping that is buried in native fill dirt and clay rather than clean gravel. This native fill increases the rate of metal corrosion. Rust can be seen on the bolts of the T-fitting. So if you can see my cursor at these bolts, that's showing the evidence of the corroding metal. And corrosion is one of the factors that can lead to pipeline failure. And there's also a crack on the T coming in from the left showing metal fatigue. So this is in the photo, it's the black line on the top half of the fitting, midway between the bolts and the pipeline and Quail Post Road. So right here, you can see a crack in that fitting. The crack was not actively leaking in 2019, but until it's replaced, there's a risk that the crack could continue to grow and the T could break apart. And so this T is proposed to be replaced as part of the 6-inch service line abandonment that was mentioned earlier. So before we get to the specifics of how the LID is administered, I just wanted to briefly recap the proposed water and street improvements. So there will be two connections to the Portland water system, one at Lancaster Road and one at Huber Street. Approximately 5,000 feet of pipeline will be constructed, ranging in size between 4 and 8 inches in diameter. New water service lines and meters will be installed. A minimum of 3 new fire hydrants will be constructed, and the existing service line will be abandoned, including the cracked T shown on the previous slide. The new water system will be built to City of Portland standards at the time of construction. And I also want to note the street improvements that are proposed. So the Water Bureau will participate in repairing the trenching and providing a full width paving overlay after construction. But I want to be clear that the LID does not include Water Bureau participation in street subgrade repair or stormwater management. The streets will continue to be privately maintained, and a separate street LID and right-of-way dedication would be required for PBOT to take over maintenance. So now I'll pass it over to Andrew Abbey from PBOT to talk about the LID administration.
Thank you, Dave. Andrew Abbey, Local Improvement District Administrator. It's a pleasure to be here before council this afternoon. As Commissioner Fritz noted, this is a council-initiated LID. You saw the slide there with the cracks in the current water system. And we just felt that it was very important to call this question early in terms of whether we will form an LID to convert this privately maintained system into a publicly maintained system. So just to kind of give you an overview of where we go from here, if council approves the resolution today, then we would come back to council in November, early November, with an LID formation ordinance. Just to let you know, there's a high volume of LIDs going in the city right now. At the start of this morning's agenda, we had 15 local improvement districts citywide. That dropped off to 14 at the end of the morning agenda. If you approve a Broadway corridor LID next month and approve this LID in November, we'll be up to a record 16 local improvement districts around the city of Portland. So when we bring this LID back in November, assuming that you approve the resolution today, council will have the prerogative to form the local improvement district if fewer than 60% of the property owners formally object to the LID. And I really want to emphasize that Dave and I reached out to the property owners and held a meeting in July to talk about the different options for the private water system, including but not limited to a local improvement district. So that property owner meeting was held in July. And then as Commissioner Frist noted, following that meeting, Commissioner Frist made the decision to initiate the formation of this LID and call the question of whether it becomes a public system. So I think the key thing for council to understand is even though this LID has two phases of construction, with the first phase occurring in early 2021 and then the second phase occurring in 2039, the Portland Water Bureau will assume maintenance responsibility for Quail Park upon LID formation, which would occur on November 12th of this year. So for the next 19 years, the property owners and the HOA would no longer have to worry about their water system and would have until 2039 to actually pay the assessment. Assuming that council approves this LID in November, then after the first of the year, the Portland Water Bureau would start design of the project. And as Dave noted, the first phase of construction would occur in the first half of 2021. The final assessment hearing does not occur until all of the work, both phases of construction, is complete. So council would not see this LID come back for final assessment until 2039. Even in 2039, the property owners would have the ability to either pay in full or finance for up to 20 years. So a property owner could actually not start paying on this LID until 2039 and finish paying for it in 2059. What's really important to note is these costs are capped and guaranteed, with one exception that I'll mention in a moment. So what the property owners are getting, in addition to the Water Bureau taking over the system in November, is they're also getting cost certainty and financial planning that simply could not be accomplished with a homeowners association. So when we bring the ordinance back in November, assuming that council approves the resolution today, it's extremely unlikely that we would assess this LID before 2039, but there will be a provision in the LID formation ordinance that comes back to you that says that there would be a prorated LID cost applied if the LID were assessed early. So if you look at the overall cost of this project, the cost per property owner is approximately $64,000, and about 70% of that would be paid by the property owners, approximately $45,000 per property, with the Water Bureau picking up the difference of $19,000. I do want to note that the cost cap and guarantee does not apply to the cost of acquiring property rights. So we have assumed that the Homeowners Association will donate the necessary property rights to build the project. And we specifically wanted to avoid a moral hazard situation where there would be an economic incentive for the HOA not to dedicate the or provide the necessary easements and then incur additional costs to Water Bureau ratepayers. And with that, we can go to the next. And
can I ask a question?
One question. Commissioner Hardesty has her hand raised.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Andrew. Could you go back one slide, please? And so I want to be clear that I heard you correctly. So property owners don't start paying for this until 2039?
That is correct. That is correct, Commissioner Hardesty.
And when does the work start?
The work starts early next year, and then the second phase of work starts until 2039.
The second phase starts in 2039?
Correct, yeah.
I'm trying to figure out how old I'll be then. I would be really, really, really old. And so I'm just curious. This seems to be it seems bizarre, let me just say, that it is so far out that no one in the city will have remembered this conversation we're having today. But we're going to make the investment in part one. And what comes out of investment in part one, and how do we cover the cost of that?
So, Commissioner, all the costs are fully covered. All of the terms of this LID will be spelled out in the LID formation ordinance. So one of the things I shared with the property owners is that obviously there will be a certain number of property sales between now and 2039. And so what all the current and future owners of this LID will have is they will have an LID formation ordinance that spells out the terms of this local improvement district. And then, Commissioner, I think what I would really point out is what we're trying to do here is to spend the property owner's money wisely and the ratepayers' dollars wisely. So to the extent that we have some extra life to squeeze out of the system, existing system, that's why we're putting it off for 19 years. So what we didn't want to come here with you today is to say we want to do everything all at once. And oh, by the way, whatever, you know, water bill rate you've established for the next fiscal year, you're going to have to bump that up because we're going to do everything, you know, right away. We're just going to take care of the really important stuff early next year and then defer the other items until later on.
Thank you. That is extremely helpful. And you said that we have the resources to do part one. And is that based on the Water Bureau's current reserves? You have the resources to do the whole thing, but you're just not collecting it back from the property owners for 19 years?
Yeah, so nothing gets collected from the property owners until everything is done, but because 70% of the LID is paid for by the property owners, in effect, we're drawing against a interim line of credit, LID line of credit, to have the water bill reimbursed as that first phase of the cost of the first phase of construction are incurred.
So it sounds like we're taking a, it sounds like the city is investing in the promise that in 20 years, we'll start being reimbursed for the investments we've already made, and then we will make some additional investments.
Yeah, we make the initial investments early next year, and then we make the bulk of the investments in dollar terms in 2039.
Thank you very much. That's been very helpful. I was confusing myself, but I wanted to make sure that I was actually hearing what I was hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Your question is really good. And I think what you really got into is the heart of the complex issue that we were grappling with. I worked with the former Water Bureau Director, Mike Storer, and then with Director Solmer, and of course, Dave Evanuk all the way through. And we had looked at a variety of different timing options and financing options. And I won't bore you with some of the things that sort of wound up on the cutting room floor, but this is what we came up with. What we were really trying to do is to provide cost predictability and stability to the property owners. And I think even more importantly, we wanted to make it so as soon as the gavel drops in November, people don't have to worry about whether water is going to come out of their tap in the morning. Any one of a number of different scenarios you can kind of envision. It's hard enough doing a homeowners association, for example, to maintain private streets, but to really worry about your tap working in the morning and all that is frankly not something I'd want to have to wrestle with, let alone go to monthly meetings to talk about keeping our water flowing. All right, so that last slide provided you an overview of the LID, and the final slide I just wanted to show you is from the Deltawood LID that Commissioner Fritz mentioned in her introductory remarks. I think one of the important things to understand is when you have a homeowners association that divvies up the water bill, there are a couple of things that kind of work against the property owners. Number one is there's no opportunity for a low-income discount because you have one meter serving a homeowners association as opposed to individual property owners. There's also not an incentive to save water. So if you think about this particular LID, there's one or two new services in there, but if you just, for simplicity's sake, assume that there's 96 water services, if you just let your tap run and you waste water, then in effect, you're paying 196 of the bill and your neighbors pay 95, 96 of the bill. So you waste water or you use more water or, you know, you water your lawn every single day as opposed to, you know, get a sensor to only water your lawn when it's dry out. I think you get the gist of what I'm trying to say. There really isn't an incentive to save water. Now, having said that, we have not seen remarkable patterns of usage here as we did in Deltawood. And I think what that really speaks to is A, most property owners are conscientious, and B, they're not currently experiencing a leak problem. But one of the issues that we had in Deltawood is, for, you know, they didn't have a leak problem until they did have a leak problem. And then once that system started leaking a lot of water, it was quite the back and forth between the HOA and the Water Bureau to try to issue credits. The Water Bureau didn't really want to issue credits until there was a plan in place to deal with the leaks. So really the picture I'm trying to paint for council here is we're just trying to get ahead of the curve here and just get this all figured out before there's a leak and before there's a problem. Just to show you the example of Deltawood, and I really want to emphasize these are apples and oranges comparison, so take this with a grain of salt, but I'm just trying to illustrate a financial picture for you. When we did the Deltawood LID, when we formed it, we assumed the cost would be $19,000 per property owner. They clocked in at about $16,000 per property owner, so there's a little bit of a savings there. From about $152 a month to $120 a month. And then here's what was really interesting. The average monthly bill to the property owners after they were billed by the HOA was $141 a month. With stopping all the water leaks, that went down to $60 a month. And then for those who qualified for a low-income discount, it actually went down even further, to the point where with a low-income discount, the savings on the HOA dues and the savings on the wasted water basically, and the low-income discount basically paid for the LID. I'm not suggesting that will necessarily happen here to the extent that we may not have a lot of low-income property owners, but the way I would encourage council to think about it is, while we don't have any control over what the HOA chooses to charge for their dues, really the way I'd think about this is the property owners will be redirecting their funds from paying the HOA to pay for water and then budget reserves for water system improvements. And instead they'll pay the city as part of a one-time cost. And they can actually start saving for that now over the next 19 years and take whatever level of HOA savings that they may have and plow that into the future assessment of the LID. Even if they don't do that and we get to 2039, they will have the ability to finance up completely in full for up to 20 years. So that concludes my presentation. I really appreciate the opportunity to have the partnership with not one, but two Water Bureau directors, and Dave Evanek and Commissioner Fritz, and myself, Director Solmer, and Dave are all available to answer any questions that my council might have before we turn it over to testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Good job as always. Commissioner Hardis, do you have your hand raised?
Yes, I do have one more question. I just didn't want to interrupt again.
No worries.
Okay, one question is that the Water Bureau says, except for acquiring property rights, the Water Bureau would cover any cost that any cost overruns or anything was over the cost that was in the resolution. And so, you know, when I see that, that just makes me just shake in my boots. What is the potential for it to end up costing the Water Bureau significantly more than you originally estimated?
I'm going to let Dave answer that question. I do know that a contingency factor was built in.
Yeah, we built a contingency factor of, I believe it was 38%, and then another inflation factor of, I think it was 45% into the total.
And so that means that that's already built in. So if you go over that, you're still going to pick up the cost?
If we go over the contingency or over the inflation, then the proposal is that the Water Bureau would pick up any cost overruns that went over that.
And what is the potential for that to happen?
I guess anything could happen in 18 years. You know, some of our cost estimates come in low, some come in high. There's a range of, plus or minus on the amount. I couldn't say exactly without going back to other specific projects and look at how those cost estimates have performed to say what the exact potential is. But there is a potential that it could be higher than what's shown.
And Commissioner, I might just add, I think what you're really getting to is that there's a risk here. And when we put this LID together, the question is, who do we want to settle with the risk? Do we want to settle the property owners with the risk, or do we want to settle the Water Bureau with the risk? And there's no right or wrong answer, right? But even building in the contingency, we're looking at about $45,000 per property owner. You know, my sense of it is that it's hard enough as a residential property owner to budget for that amount of money, even if it is 19 years out in the future. I just think it would have been a really hard sell if we said, oh, it's going to be $45,000. And by the way, if it goes over, it goes over. So I guess the way I like to think of this, Commissioner, is we're really incentivizing the Water Bureau. Dollar, we're really incentivizing them to save money. And, you know, they have the flexibility, for example, if I'm just throwing this out, I don't work for the Water Bureau, I'm not a Water Bureau engineer, but let's just say we started seeing some crazy construction inflation. They could just look at this and say, hey, you know, we have another X number of years of life on the pipe, but whoa, these construction costs are really skyrocketing. We'll just go ahead and move up this second phase of construction and do it earlier and try to get ahead of the curve. The beauty of having the LID formed is that it's all locked in place, and the Water Bureau has a lot of flexibility in terms of when it does that second phase of construction. Most likely it wouldn't be because of inflationary concerns. It would just be because just took a nosedive, you know, the system just took a nosedive, and well, we can't wait till 2039, we need to do it 2034. This way, the council approval in place, and that decision can just be made administratively by the Water Bureau.
So I am very grateful and appreciate the very thoughtful answers. I guess I have a question for legal counsel. I'm under the impression that we can't tie financial obligations to a later city council, right? So in 19 years or 18 years, the chances of any of us still being on the city council and being functional is pretty slim. And so I guess that may be a legal question, because I understand that bureaus like infrastructure bureaus have to plan for the long term. But I get nervous when I see as a blank check that something may happen, say 10 years from now, that causes us to rethink this brilliant new idea. I'm concerned when we tie the hands of previous councils to be able to react responsibly if something radically changes. And, you know, and before this year, not all of us would be saying, well, what could happen, right? But we don't say that anymore. So I guess that's my big concern. And Mayor, I don't know if, and maybe even Commissioner Fritz has some insight for me. That is, that that causes me concern when you have such a significant contingency built in, and then you also add language that says it will cover any other overruns that happen. You know, that makes me nervous. Thank you.
Commissioner, I want to let Naomi respond if she wants to. I guess what I would point out to council is that in effect, every LID that's ever formed basically encumbers the future council. So, you know, the deal points of an LID are put together at LID formation. So every LID you form encumbers future councils. I think what I'm hearing you say is what's unusual here is that 19-year duration. I hope you're all living a, you know, long, healthy. But will you all be here in 19 years?
No.
I don't know. So again, just trying to, you know, get as much life out of the existing system as possible. I guess, well, I don't know, Naomi, do you want to address the legal question there? Director Solmer, do you want to chime in here as well?
Sorry, this is Naomi. I would like a little bit, I actually can try to make a quick call. I don't typically advise the Water Bureau or others who do this. I had the same thought initially as Andrew that this is something that encumbering a future council with all of the LIDs, but I can actually try to kind of get some confirmation from that. If I can jump on a phone call right now and see if I can get someone else who has a little more experience with this.
Commissioner Udaly.
It's actually me, Mayor.
Yeah, I didn't raise my hand.
I'm sorry, Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you. You know, that's what we do, and that's why this is a contract to do it. There's a lot of things that we do that is a contract that then gets paid over time. And as was mentioned, it is different because it's 19 years away. I will note that I think Commissioner Saltzman served for 20 years, so it's possible that you might all be carrying on, but certainly Gabriel might. It's important, you know, we don't want to do it right away when there's 19 years of life left in the pipes. That doesn't make any sense. On the other hand, we want to be ready because all of these properties are going to need water if something does happen. And so that's why this was brought to our attention by some of the residents, and former Director Mike Sturr worked really hard on it. I think this is an elegant solution that is reasonable. And the other point I wanted to make is that the water system's already there. So it's not like some of the street construction we do where it's new construction. We have no idea what kind of subsoil we're going to get, what kind of rocks, whatever. This is a developed subdivision with a water system that we know where it is, and we've done some scoping, and maybe Dave can talk about this. If, you know, the photographs that you saw, we have a pretty good idea of how long the system is going to last, and where, and we know absolutely where it is.
So thank you, Commissioner. But again, I think they've sold me on the creativity of this idea about why this idea is a good one. What I'm not sold on is us picking up costs, especially with such a significant reserve already built in, and without any kind of limits on what that would be. That's my concern. I understand. And so it's fine for us to do the LIDs as we traditionally do and incumbent other councils, but I don't think it's incumbent for us to have basically a blank check for something that we don't know what we don't know. And so I am very concerned that if we agree to this in this the way it's written now, that you know, something could happen. I'm not saying something would. And Director Sumner, I think you're the bee's knees. So there's no question about your due diligence. But I'm just definitely concerned about that language. That language gets the city of Portland in trouble so often. And if we don't have a clear understanding what the parameters are, 19 years from now, there could be a big fight, and we'd lose.
Commissioner Hardesty, maybe I can help Naomi out here. Maybe this is more of a communication issue than a legal issue. If it met with the pleasure of the council, what I'd be happy to do is write something into the formation ordinance that maybe talks about informing the council and just making this up every 5 years or something like that. We could certainly provide a report to council provide current contraction trends, cost trends, or whatever else, whatever other information council is interested in. LID code does not require a hearing if there's no major cost increase to the property, but that certainly doesn't mean that we couldn't, we meaning the LID administrator and the Water Bureau, couldn't periodically inform the council of, you know, what the status is of the project, what our current, you know, cost assumptions are, that type of thing. I really have to stress this, though. The really important thing here is that what we're not doing, and I know you're not suggesting that we not approve ID, but what we're really trying to avoid here is doing nothing and walking away and then waiting for it to just be a crisis.
Right.
All of a sudden, one day, the water system falls apart and there's a huge pressure on the Water Bureau to just step up and fix it all for free. So I would just submit to you that whatever risk there may be in blowing through all of the contingency and going over the total budgeted cost to the project, I think it's a lower risk for the Water Bureau and Water Bureau ratepayers to have this dialed in now than it is to sit back and wait for something really bad to happen. I was famously quoted on the Deltawood LID that those people were sitting on a time bomb. Mm-hmm. I had people come up to me after we got that LID done and said, you know, I'm really glad we got this LID done. This was just a sword hanging over me, and I'm so relieved that I don't have to worry about it anymore. So I just kind of wanted to share that perspective with you.
Yes, I agree with you.
About dialing in a regular update, we could do that in the formation ordinance.
I think, Andrew, that is an ideal solution to my nervousness. So I thank you. I thank you all. It was a great presentation, and who knew I'd be so excited about talking about an LID. Thank you all.
So Andrew, does that conclude the presentation?
It does. If council has no further questions, I think we can turn it over to property owner testimony. Thank you, Mayor.
All right, good. And you, do you have invited testimony or should we just go right to public?
No, I think we're just running with the sign-up list. Thank you,
Mayor. All right. Keelan, how many folks do we have signed up for public testimony?
It looks like we have four people on the line to testify.
Very good. 3 minutes each. Name for the record. Keelan, we'll call your name in order.
John Gibbon.
Thank you, Mayor. My name is John Gibbon. I'm a property owner in Quail Park. Commissioner Fritz knows me, and maybe some of the rest of you remember me. I'm actively involved in Markham neighborhood matters as their land use and transportation chair. Before, I want to thank you for taking the time to recognize Commissioner Fish's birthday this morning. I had the pleasure of working with the commissioner for 5 years while I was serving on PURB. I submitted written testimony that gave you a lot of details about the Quail Park project. I will tell you that I'm took the lessons I learned on PURB and almost immediately began to work on Quail Park's problems as I got back here after serving on PURB. And I would like to speak to Commissioner Hardesty's concern. As I understood the language that drew your concern was that there was a contingency that was not covered in the ordinance which related to property acquisition. And I can assure you that there will be no additional property costs because all the property that is involved in this building of these lines is property that's either in city right-of-way, so there's no cost involved, and that would be Southwest Lancaster Place and Southwest Huber Street, or in Quail Park's common property, Quail Park, Quail Post Road, which is the entire property, serves the entire property. So The Quail Park documents, I'm also on the board of directors, I'm also a retired attorney. Quail Park documents clearly envision the property being dedicated to the city in the event the city chooses to take over our common property. And in fact, the commission should know that the sewer system inside Quail Park that serves other areas of the Markham neighborhood is actually a public sewer system that already runs through our common property. So there's a pattern of having cooperated with city-owned utilities. We need to move to a city utility. As somebody that was on PURB, my written testimony shows I would not. This is the Water Bureau solution. I wasn't going to ask for this. This is a great, elegant solution, but it's not one that I felt like I could ask the city to do. I knew about Delta Wood because I was a attorney, and I advised people who lived in Delta Wood, which is was a condominium about. To put
that's
this
3 minutes.
Thank you. I can answer any questions.
Thank you.
Next, we have Sean Cox.
Hello, Sean Cox here. I'm a homeowner here in Quail Park, and I really wanted to express my gratitude for the thoughtful approach that the Water Bureau, Andrew, and the team have taken to try to address this critical risk that we have as neighbors. The T connection that we saw in the presentation is in my backyard. The neighborhood, the homeowners association, has done some investigation through our partners here in the neighborhood, looking at the improvements that need to be made, and kind of centered around a concern that perhaps working with the city would have an inflated cost, or would have some other limitations that maybe if we worked independently, we wouldn't have. And we found universally that the approach that the LAD team has proposed is as economical as any other. And it also, at this moment in time, while we're having this meeting virtually because we're in the middle of a pandemic, realizing that there's a risk that's as great as the one that we are facing, and getting a solution that we can plan for over the next 20 years versus have to try to burden the current residents with 100% of a replacement now is provides a great deal of peace of mind. And I just wanted to express, you know, my strong support for the LID progressing, and also appreciation for the process that the Water Bureau and Andrew have gone through. They've been very proactive in answering all questions, very responsive to the concerns of the community. And I think that has set up a precedent that the partnership that we could roll forward out of this LID is one that can help us establish a strong future for the water system here in Quail Park. And with that, I will close.
Thank you.
Next we have Russell Montgomery.
Good afternoon. My name is Russell Montgomery. I'm a Quail Park resident and a licensed civil engineer who has worked on land development and transportation projects for over 17 years. Like most of my neighbors here, when we had that July 16th video conference, we were all pretty shocked at that $45,000 price tag that each of us individually would be on the hook for in 2039 if the LID resolution is adopted. That's more than twice what I had to put down as a down payment on my house. So I was a little startled at that. And my initial take was that cost estimate had to be, you know, really out of whack. But I'd started generating my own cost estimate based on recent projects I have here in the area. And I also gathered some data from other colleagues at other local engineering firms, and found that in the terms of current dollars, the Water Bureau's estimate was in line with what it would take for the homeowners association to undertake the water improvement works privately. So given this information and the fact that under the LID, the Portland Water Bureau would assume system maintenance responsibilities and costs moving forward, I am in support of the LID resolution. It will ensure safe and ongoing water supply to our neighborhood and prevent any future need for special assessments to the homeowners in the event of any future water system issues. It doesn't sound like this is going to be popular, but if there's any way to increase, you know, from capital improvement dollars, the Water Bureau or the city's share in this to reduce our $45,000 each, that would be great. We are rate payers. We have been as an HOA for nearly 50 years. So it's not like we're on well water and asking to switch over to the city water. You know, we've been paying our rates, and it would be great if we could find a way to shift a little bit more of those CIP dollars into this project. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Richard Lane.
Hey, Richard.
Good afternoon. This is Richard Lane. I am also one of the 96 homeowners directly impacted by the proposal. A lot of my comments actually had to do with process and procedure. I don't know that I agree that there's been a full vetting of this with the property owners. I know that there was the Zoom call that Mr. Montgomery just referred to, and sort of the sticker shock that was presented. But I have been impressed with all of the discussion here today. And despite what I have an objection to characterizing a long and extensive dialogue with the homeowners, I'm prepared to actually see this thing move forward. Based upon my understanding this afternoon, I'd echo Mr. Montgomery's comment about sticker shock and costs. You know, people bought into Quail Post sort of with clean hands, not knowing a lot about what was going on here. And if there are deficiency, it was built without anybody's knowledge. And this is a proposal that gives people a little planning opportunity, but it's still a significant hit on the homeowners being affected. So I thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Keelan. Does that complete our public testimony?
Yes, for 785, yes.
All right, good. Is there any further questions for my colleagues before we call the roll on the resolution?
This is Naomi Sheffield from the City Attorney's Office. I just wanted to know if you wanted, I did get a little bit of additional clarification if you like. I don't know how helpful it will be, but Commissioner Hardesty, I wanted to offer it up. So I think you kind of your explanation of generally that one council can't bind another council on policy is correct. I think what we will be looking at here is essentially though in terms of contract rights, you know, if the city enters into a contract, even if the contract has an unknown contingency amount, you know, then we could have a contractual obligation. And under the contracts clause of the Oregon Constitution, you know, the city can be bound to those amounts, and even if they are varying. And so in terms of kind of the legal ability to do that, I think that is correct. And I guess an analogy to think of is, you know, the state with their PERS litigation, and the state's bound by those contractual obligations, even though the amount, you know, is unknown and could vary. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you, it was.
All right, good. This is a resolution. Keelan, please call the roll.
Hardesty.
I want to thank Director Solmer for that very thorough presentation. It's amazing the things you get interested in when you are a member of the City Council. And I also want to thank Andrew for helping to put my mind at ease as we move forward with this. And I will say having periodic updates would be very helpful for me personally, and I suspect for whatever council exists in like 10 years and 19 years, it would be helpful as well. And also, I want to acknowledge what I heard from a couple of the homeowners, the sticker shock. And because we can't see them, I'm assuming that they were across the age spectrum that I could hear from their voices. And so I do think keeping us informed and how it's impacting the property owners would also be very helpful as we move forward. And let me just say, I appreciate the creativity and the thinking long-term, because, you know, we need to do that much more often. I really appreciated the problem solving that we did here collectively today, because I know that you put a lot of work into it, and I certainly have no intentions of slowing down the process. But I also heard that maybe we ought to do another Zoom meeting with neighbors just to make sure that everybody who couldn't make that call will have an opportunity to hear the same information that the first call had. So again, thank you for really excellent work. Thank you, Commissioner Fritz, for helping us resolve my little sticky point. And I appreciate legal counsel's advice as well, that I will definitely take into account as we get the updates. And so I'm happy to vote aye.
You, Daly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Thank you very much to everybody who participated and who has participated over many years with this gnarly problem. Commissioner Hardesty, the matter will be coming back to us in November after the property owners have an opt-out vote in advance of the formative ordinance. So, even without this, the Bureau is committed to continuing the outreach, particularly with the pandemic. It's always very difficult to reach. It's even more difficult to reach folks, and our team will continue to strive to do so. Thank you, Andrew Abbey, and your partnership with the Portland Bureau of Transportation. And thank you, Water Bureau staff, Dave Evanuk, Gabriel Solner, and Michael Sturr, who is now happily in retirement when he's not fighting fires around his ranch, and who put a lot of time and effort into this challenge. So thanks to everybody. Oh, and thank you also to Astrid Jorgoy on my staff. Aye.
Ryan?
Yes, I'll vote aye.
Wheeler?
Aye, the resolution is adopted. Thanks everybody for your hard work on this. Appreciate it, Commissioner Fritz. Thank you, Andrew, to the whole team. Well done. Next item is item 786, time certain.
Transmit report to the City of Portland on Portland Police Bureau officer involved shootings and in custody deaths by the Office of Independent Review.
Colleagues, before I turn this over to Madam Auditor Paul Caballero, I'd like to just set the scene here. This is the seventh report that's been delivered by OIR since 2012. My desire is that we will ultimately not need their services at some point, but sadly, I suspect this is not the last report the council will or should receive. Today marks the second anniversary of the death of Patrick Kimmons, who was shot to death by Portland police in downtown Portland. The shooting of Mr. Kimmons is reviewed by the OIR group in this most recent report. The loss of any life at the hands of police is tragic, and it represents multiple systemic failures. I'd like to reserve a moment of silence for Mr. Kimmons, who was only 27 at the time of his death, and for the other lives lost and impacted as a result of police shootings. Thank you. None of us could have predicted the events that have unfolded since this report was initially released in April. A global pandemic and a national movement for racial justice at a scale not seen in our nation for at least the last 50 years. As leaders, we're accountable to the people we serve. We're listening to the voices in this community calling for police reform and accountability. The centering of Black and Brown lives continues to be a priority for this administration and for this city council. Any use of force by a police officer deserves review. When it results in the loss of life, it's devastating and it deserves the highest level of review. The use of deadly force is the most critical decision a police officer can make. And that's why we've consistently sought outside experts like OIR to examine the police bureau's performance and hold the bureau and us, city leadership, accountable for these changing decisions. In this report, OIR makes several recommendations to improve the bureau's performance. They also recognize the bureau's ongoing cooperation with the review process and its willingness to adopt most of the recommendations delivered over the years, including those in the report that we're considering today. Officers are entrusted to make decisions under incredibly challenging and complex circumstances. We demand that our officers consider their years of training and their knowledge of PPB policies, as well as their instincts, and that they thoughtfully apply them in their interactions with the public, often under circumstances that are unpredictable and potentially dangerous. Officers engage in those interactions with training, expertise, and a firearm. Our expectations as a community around officer conduct should absolutely be high because so much is ultimately at stake. And that's why reviews like the one presented today are so critical. OIR provides a valuable function for the city. As a third-party reviewer of officer-involved shootings in Portland for the last several years, their reviews enable us to assess whether the police bureau's current policies and training are reflected in practice, and the practice reflects the needs of our communities. As leaders, we need to ensure that the correct policies and training are in place so that if an officer makes the decision to use deadly force, he or she does so with the proper foundation in place. Though there continue to be areas for improvement within the police bureau, it's important to emphasize, as the OIR group does, the good work the Bureau has done and continues to do to improve its training, systems, processes, and accountability to the public we serve. Last year, with the presentation of the sixth report, I asked a full update be presented to the City Council at the time of the next report. The police chief and members of his team are here to provide that update and to answer any questions. I want to thank Chief Lavelle for representing the Bureau here today, and I'd like to thank the OIR group for their critical eye in conducting this work and for their partnership on these issues. Auditor Mary Hull Caballero is here today to introduce representatives from the OIR group who will discuss the report and answer any questions the Council may have. Madam Auditor, welcome, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mayor. Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. I am City Auditor Mary Hall Caballero, for the record. Few things have more consequential effects on our community than when Portland police officers fire their weapons and kill or injure someone. The effects ripple through families, streets, and neighborhoods. Police shootings create immediate anguish, alter lives, and may lead to pain and grief that lingers years after such a profound incident occurs. The government gives police officers the authority to use force and provides them with the training and equipment to do so, including a variety of firearms. It is the city's responsibility to limit officer-involved shootings for the good of the community and the well-being of the officers. To that end, City Council authorized the auditor in 2001 to contract with experts to review closed investigations of officer-involved shootings and deaths in police custody with the goal of reducing the possibility of future incidents. Independent Police Review, a division of my office, manages the contract for the closed case reviews and facilitates communication among the experts, the police bureau, city council, and the public. City code requires the experts to issue reports to identify policy issues that need further action and make recommendations for improvement. The first such report was published in 2003. Today, I'm here to introduce the team from OIR Group to present their most recent report to Council, which is the seventh the group has completed for the City of Portland. It includes the assessments of 7 officer-involved shootings that occurred between May of 2017 and November of 2018, and a series of recommendations that call for further action. Michael Giannacco is a founding principal of OIR Group and a nationally recognized expert on law enforcement reform and accountability systems. Prior to starting OIR Group, Michael was the chief of the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Central District of California. He also was a civil rights attorney with the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. for 10 years. Robert Miller is a founding member of OIR Group and previously served in a number of roles dedicated to law enforcement accountability, including the Los Angeles County Office of Independent Review and the Los Angeles County Office of Inspector General. Julie Rulin has been a principal with OIR Group since 2006 and has deep experience advising law enforcement agencies about officer-involved shootings, investigations, policy development, and oversight systems. Julie also worked as an attorney in the Los Angeles County Office of Independent Review. And now I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Giannacco for the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Auditor, for the introductory remarks. Thank you, Mayor, for framing the issue and reminding us why these types of reviews are so important with the eye towards trying our best to learn from these incidents, to ensure that there's accountability from these incidents, and to better prepare agencies so that there is less likelihood of deadly force being used in future situations and future challenges. That's the goal of our review, and I think that should be the goal of any kind of independent assessment of these cases. As the mayor indicated, this report was prepared prior to the new renewed attention to policing in general as a result of the tragic Floyd death and other incidents that have occurred since. The national narrative has certainly increased attention to police conduct and in particular police use of force, appropriately so in my view. And you can imagine that the three of us as practitioners in oversight essentially had our phone blow up on a daily basis as other jurisdictions try to grapple with the increased and appropriate demands on accountability, increased and appropriate demands on outside review, outside involvement in police activity. We have been very busy. That being said, we have a longer relationship with the city of Portland and appreciate the opportunity over the past 7 years to come back and report our findings of our internal review process publicly to your communities, as well as you all as representatives of those communities. And so for that opportunity, we are grateful. The pandemic has obviously changed ways in which dialogue occurs these days, and we are sad that we are not able to make this presentation in person. But we are enthused that we are able to make a presentation under unique circumstances and hopefully for not much longer. The report is lengthy. The intent of our initial remarks are not to go over every jot and tittle and finding and recommendation of our report. There's not time for that, and the report in many ways speaks for itself. But what we thought we would do in a few minutes at least is to talk about some high-level findings that we think are maybe the most important for purposes of discussion. And then obviously during this session, the three of us are available to respond to any questions any commissioner might have regarding anything in our report. That is how we intend to proceed with the leave of counsel. The report has 28 recommendations and a number of findings. I would suggest that perhaps some of the more prescient and important findings have to do with new topics revisited, and, I'm sorry, with old topics revisited and with new ones presented. Today's challenges are not yesterday's, although sometimes there are recurring themes. The first point and finding that we want to ensure we talk about has to do with an issue that we have been dealing with the Bureau for years, almost since our first assignment in 2012. And that has to do with the question of when an involved officer is an involved officer is to provide a statement of his or her state of mind, that is the explanation for why they chose to use deadly force under the situation presented to the officer. When we first got started, it was sometimes a matter of days and sometimes even a matter of weeks or months before that officer was required to provide a statement about what he saw, what she saw, and what caused them to feel the need to use deadly force. I have to say that over the years, as a result of involvement by elected officials, involvement by police leadership, that has improved substantially. And now it's the case that within 2 days, and not outside 2 days, within 2 days, the Bureau does obtain an account of what occurred from the involved officer. While 2 days is certainly a significant improvement over 2 months, in our view, it still is not good enough and is not consistent with best police practices, best investigative practices. As we indicate in our report, we believe that the appropriate measure of when an officer involved in a shooting should provide information about what occurred and an explanation and an accounting of what occurred should happen before the officer is excused from duty and sent home. Otherwise, if that protocol is not adopted, you're going to have situations in which officers will not provide statements until information about the event is out there in the atmosphere, out there in the public arena, that may and sometimes will contaminate or impact the officer's account of what transpired. We know that there was information in 2 of the 7 shooting cases that was publicly released by the city prior to the involved officer being interviewed. And therefore, there can be no guarantee that that information didn't color, impact either intentionally or subconsciously the account of the officer. There's no way of guaranteeing that. The only way of guaranteeing a pure statement that just has the officer's impressions and state of mind is to interview the officer, be the officer before the officer goes home. Obviously, there would be extenuating circumstances in some cases, such as when an officer is injured. But I think the presumption should be that an officer is interviewed contemporaneously and before the shift ends. The second protocol
Michael, before you move off of that one, Commissioner Hardesty wanted to pose a question or a comment at this point.
Yes. Sorry, Commissioner, I didn't see your hand up. Thank you.
That's okay, Michael. It is really good to see your team once again, if it is in those little boxes that we're looking at now. And first, let me just thank you all. The work that you do is really valuable, and it is really useful to the transformation that the city of Portland is going through. I wanted to stop you on this hour, on this question that has come up over and over again. And I'm actually a little surprised that we still are waiting 48 hours before we interview an officer who's been involved in a shooting. When you first started actually doing these reviews, there was a union issue. It was part of the contract that prohibited that from happening. During the last contract talks, that went away. So I'm puzzled by the fact that we continue to wait 48 hours before there's a response. And my assumption was that they were required to give a statement on site at the time of the incident before the end of their shift. And so there seems to be a disconnect between what we, as the elected officials who actually have to operate within the contractual agreements that we have and with the practices in Portland Police Bureau. And I guess, so my question to you, you've been doing, this is the seventh report, right? And I suspect that in the past, there was a reason why that didn't happen. Is there a reason now you're given by the Bureau that that doesn't happen?
Yes, Commissioner. And we, this was reinforced in a meeting we had earlier today with the chief, but certainly the chief can speak to himself, but the report, the response from the Bureau is that they believe that it is important to wait a little while so that the investigators can collect information about the incident and be better prepared to interview the officer before that interview takes place. As we've explained to the chief, that comes at a cost, though. That comes at a cost whereby exposure to outside information, whether advertent or inadvertent, will certainly contaminate the peer statement of the officer. And the other point that I think should be made is that you can interview the officer before the officer goes home in sort of a what happened and why did you do what you did? And there's always the opportunity to re-interview the officer as the investigators collect more information. So it can be a two-stage process, which I think would eliminate the stated concerns of the Bureau.
I agree. Thank you.
Thank you. The second protocol that I wanted to speak of, and then I'll turn some of the discussion over to my colleagues, has to do with another protocol that more and more agencies recognize as an important piece. As agencies have become more transparent, and as agencies have done a better job of providing information about the incident sooner rather than later, providing any video evidence of the incident sooner rather than later, as that is being done, there also has been a recognition that special attention needs to be paid with regard to providing information to those directly impacted by the event. And what I'm talking about in a case in which somebody has died, family members of the decedent, and finding a way to provide that information as fastly, as quickly, as effectively, and as importantly as possible. In addition, as the mayor indicates, these kinds of incidents have ripple effects not only on the individuals particularly and directly involved, but the communities from which these individuals live, whether that's a neighborhood or whether that's a racial component or an ethnic component or other. There are just connectivity in which this information needs to be presented to them as special victims, if you will, of the event. And so what we have suggested is that the Bureau do formally what other agencies have done, which is to rethink about how are we going to best impart this information to those directly impacted by the event and to those communities directly impacted by the event. And what we have seen effectively work in other jurisdictions is two things. One is to have private meetings with family members before there's release of any other information so that they're not seeing it for the first time in YouTube or on the Bureau's website about what has transpired, that they get advance information. And then within days have a community meeting in which not the facts, because the facts necessarily are still being developed, but at least the sentiment and the understanding of how this has impacted, and even a statement about, you know, how every life is important and sort of an understanding and a recognition for the loss of a loved one under any conditions and how difficult that can be. That kind of sentiment, that kind of community meeting, in my view, goes a very long way to start the healing process that will never entirely heal over those scars, but will certainly be an important piece to any messaging and to any kind of Bureau, and more importantly, citywide response to the event. So we recommend that, and I believe the Bureau is receptive to that type of recommendation. Julie, I'm going to turn over you to talk about a couple more recommendations. We'll go around the lap, and then we'll present for additional questions.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. I want to first just echo Mike's sentiment that about how sad we are that we're not there to present this report in person and to visit your city. We've always enjoyed that interaction, and so we'll do it this way, but hopefully not for too much longer.
We'll accept a rain check on that, Julie. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you, Mayor. There are two fundamental questions that an organization needs to answer following a critical incident like an officer-involved shooting. The first is, were there any violations of policy? And the second is, what could we do better next time? Too often, police agencies are defensive about this second question. And you know, asking what could the officers have done differently or better is seen as a sort of unfair second guessing of officers who were responding to a stressful situation. One of the things that I've enjoyed most about our work in Portland is that your police bureau is not among those agencies that have that sort of knee-jerk defensive response to critique. On the contrary, we have frequently complimented the Bureau for its thoroughness in its review processes and its willingness to learn from these events. But our job, though, is to point out the times when it has fallen short and to make recommendations for improvements. And in this report, we identify a number of places where we felt that the Bureau's analysis did not fully address all the possible alternative decision-making and possible alternative scenarios. And we suggest some modifications that could address those concerns. For example, officers decided not to wait for additional backup or additional responding officers before engaging with Mr. Peoples. Whether or not that was the correct decision, an analysis of the various factors that went into the decision is the type of analysis and the type of thing that should automatically and routinely be included in any analysis of a shooting incident. Likewise, questions about planning, positioning, availability of cover in the incident involving Ms. Brown are issues that should always be fully addressed, but weren't here. And there are other examples of these kinds of alternative decision-making, alternative scenarios that might have worked out or that should have been addressed that we felt the Bureau's review process did not fully explore in the shootings that we reviewed, including those involving Mr. Elifritz and Mr. Brockner, questions about communication among officers, use of the canines, and communication with the subjects. We think that these are the types of questions that the Bureau would more reliably address in all of these incidents if the Police Review Board was directed to make explicit findings regarding pre-shooting tactical decision-making. It used to be that the Police Review Board would always look at the policy question, that first question, were there any violations of policy? They, in recent years, started looking at that, but also recognizing that there were sometimes concerns about what happened after the shooting, started making explicit findings about post-shooting procedures. How quickly was medical care provided? How was the scene handled? Whether officers were appropriately separated and these kinds of things. And we have found that to be incredibly helpful in correcting some of the issues and concerns that we had in some of the early shootings that we reviewed in the early part of our time with Portland. And we think that adding a sort of pre-shooting tactical decision-making component to the list of express findings that the Police Review Board needs to address and explicitly say yay or nay on, that would more reliably address some of these issues that we identified in our report. It's a recommendation that we made in each of our last two reports from 2018 and 2019, We didn't, it's not in the list of recommendations here because these cases had all been adjudicated prior to that 2019 report. But we understand that this is still not a thing that the Police Review Board has implemented. And so we wanted to reiterate it here and address it again. I'm going to turn it over to Rob now, unless anyone's got questions on this, or we can come back to it.
Thank you, Julie. Rob, one thing that is critical to any effective review protocol is getting the facts of the incident. And there have been some challenges in getting facts with regard to others who may have important information that have declined to cooperate in the investigations. So I'm going to turn it over to Rob to explain what those challenges have been. Rob? You're muted, Rob. You're muted, Rob.
I have a strong desire to self-mute, clearly. Thanks a lot, Commissioners Hardesty, Fritz, Udaly, and Ryan. Welcome to this process, Commissioner Ryan. This is obviously something we've been doing cyclically for about 9 years now. And thank you, Mr. Mayor. I guess I didn't say that out loud yet. It's a pleasure to be here, even in this electronic format. We look forward to a somewhat more vivid experience as well in the not too distant future. What Mike was referring to is sort of condensed into three recommendations we make in the body of our discussion of the Barry incident. Mr. Barry was died in the course of being taken into custody, and he died very shortly thereafter in the hospital. He was taken into custody by sort of a three-part process, or there were three agencies involved. First, Portland State University Police and safety officers. They called for assistance. Portland Police Bureau officers came and continued the struggle with him very briefly. And then shortly thereafter, he was restrained, and medical personnel, emergency medical teams from both the fire department and AMR arrived. Now, those details are only relevant to my point that I'll emphasize right now, because they describe a fairly typical interaction of more than one police agency or city agency, or even contracted personnel such as the AMR emergency medical team. These kinds of interactions happen all the time. But there is a circumstance that is emphasized by this case, but not unique to this case, that really hamstrings effective internal affairs investigation following a incident that results in death like this one. And that is that the other agency personnel, both PSU officers and safety personnel, as well as fire department personnel, and even the county contractor AMR, ambulance services, didn't cooperate with the request by internal affairs to interview them. They had not only been at the scene, but the PSU people had information that Portland police couldn't have, because they didn't get there until the middle of the incident, Portland police. And then the fire personnel had further information, fire and AMR, because they're medically trained, for one thing, and they went off in an ambulance with Mr. Barry. This is not a technicality. It's really an unacceptable circumstance that cuts an internal affairs investigation off at the knees. We have praised, and I think justifiably, Internal Affairs thoroughness and their striving to really get at the full spectrum of circumstances before, during, and after an incident that are relevant. Some of those, that expansion of purview has come at our urging over the years, and we're very gratified to see that. But when they run into a brick wall like this, that is just really not acceptable.
Excuse me, Mayor, could I cut in and ask the question, please?
You bet. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Robert. I wanted to assure you that I'll be talking to the fire chief about why they didn't respond, and the fact that you said that this is not an anomaly, that this is kind of normal. I will make sure that we have a protocol in place by the time you present your next report on how fire will be responsive to those requests. That should be a very easy fix. And if they'd called the commissioner in charge, they may have gotten some support in that.
I certainly agree with you, Commissioner Hardesty. It's almost a uniquely fixable problem. And it's a great opportunity for city leaders because they can get the ball rolling. It's not really solely in the hands of police personnel. So I'm very gratified to hear that. One thing that I would note is that the investigators persisted, at least with fire and AMR, to the extent that they engaged in a rather innovative use of your IPR's relatively new subpoena authority, and they asked IPR to issue subpoenas to those personnel, and that was ignored as well.
So, Robert, I noticed that the police say they have no authority to. What is the process when you issue a subpoena? What is supposed to happen?
Well,
if the person doesn't show up, I should say, right?
What's the remedy for enforcement? It all depends on the nature of the subpoena and what your relationship to the court is at that point. In Oregon, there are all kinds of subpoenas. This is the usual, most people think of a criminal subpoena, but there are also administrative discovery subpoenas. And there's, in different situations, there are different remedies, but suffice it to say that while this is not a criminal subpoena, it still carries consequences if you don't comply. And those can be fines, essentially, or court being held in contempt by a court. That would require some action to intervene on behalf of the court. The point for us is the police bureau and internal affairs should never be in a position where they have to really try to enforce a subpoena. A subpoena itself means that your relationship with brother and sister agencies or contractors has broken down severely.
Yeah, and I don't know what the answer is for AMR. It is a private contractor contracted by Multnomah County.
Right.
But again, nothing stops us from picking up the phone, calling Multnomah County, saying, what's up with this, right? So
no, it really doesn't, I don't think. I mean, there are mutual aid agreements between the police bureau and nearby agencies, Gresham, for instance, and those, they're used to cooperating, right. And they do. It's really just a matter of, I think, getting people in the habit and making sure everybody is on the same page as to the importance of this to the same public that everybody serves.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
Sure.
The last piece that I wanted to talk about and then open up for discussion, commissioners, has to do with an observation we made after reviewing the grand jury transcripts in a couple of cases that were presented over this term. We've had issues with some of the grand jury presentations in the past, but the one issue that presented itself in this series of events had to do with prosecutors calling Bureau officers from the training division to opine about the appropriateness of the use of force before a grand jury, whereas the officers who were called had no particular familiarity with the incident. They had no firsthand information about the facts that had been collected. And at the time of the grand jury presentation, the Bureau hadn't even considered whether or not the actions of the officer was in policy or out of policy. So what you end up having it is a dynamic where grand jurors are being presented an opinion from a training officer, which I assume a grand jury would be seriously impacted by. And I think that the testimony of the officer would carry great weight with regard to the grand jury, who don't know about police practices. Yet the officer who's testifying, again, has no firsthand information about the facts. The facts haven't even been completely developed. There hasn't been an internal determination by the Bureau itself about whether the action was within or outside of policy. Yet the training officer is being asked the question of the DA, was it okay, was it within your policy for the officer to use deadly force under the situation that I just told you, which is a very brief narration of the facts as I know them to be. And I just don't think that is a very effective, good process. And I do think that it can only lead to continued distrust by the community in the process. Grand juries are intended to be a fair process and an important process. I appreciate the fact that the transcripts have been released for some number of years now. But review of those transcripts suggests that there seems to be a thumb on the scale of the involved officers. At least this part of it suggests that there is. And we suggest, and the Bureau, I think, agrees that they instruct their personnel not to answer the question when posed by the prosecutor about whether the particular shooting was in or out of policy. We just hope that that process stops. The other thing—
Can I ask a question before you move off of that point?
Yes, so, Mayor, yes.
And that's a really interesting point, and I appreciate you raising it. What is the consequence of the police bureau telling the prosecutor, no, we will not comply with your request? Doesn't that look a little defensive?
I think that no, and I can say this because I have been in that same situation, Mayor. So there have been attempts to designate me as an expert in a particular shooting that I reviewed. And I have been able to tell the prosecutor, even before I get sworn, that I don't feel that I am equipped at this point, since I don't have any firsthand information, to opine on that issue. And therefore, you are putting me at a disadvantage to opine. And if you force me to testify, that's going to have to be my answer.
Why would the prosecutor ask a trainee to be an expert on anything?
It's not a trainee, and maybe I wasn't clear. It's somebody from the training bureau.
Oh, I see. Okay, so somebody who can speak to what the training practices are, but don't know anything about the case. That's your objection? Is they don't
exactly
know? Okay. So you're not questioning their knowledge of policing. You're just saying they weren't there. They're not witnesses. They're not directly involved in the case. And therefore, they can't speak to the case itself.
That's right.
What if they were asked instead a different question or agreed under a different set of circumstances? What if they agreed, but only to the extent that they're providing general knowledge about training as opposed to being experts on the case?
Yes, I think that is a valid exercise. By that, I mean I would have no problem bringing in somebody from the training group to talk about what the current expectations are, what the current policies are, what the, you know, what the current protocols are, and what the current training is. That's not a problem. It's that second, the ultimate question, which is, now that you've explained that, what do you think about what the officer did in this case? And again, the witness has no knowledge about that.
So let me ask one more question, then I'll move on, or let my colleague, I see Commissioner Hardesty has her hand raised. Is there any opposing voice? I think I know the answer to this question, but I sort of want to get it on the record. Is there an opposing voice or a cross-examination or somebody in that grand jury setting who would say, look, I respect you as a training officer, you know your stuff inside out and about training, but you weren't there, were you? Or you don't have direct firsthand experience or knowledge about what happened. There's nobody who plays that role in a grand jury process, is there?
There is nobody structurally to play that role. Grand jurors sometimes may ask a question that the DA doesn't like, but the grand jury does not provide sufficient, they don't know enough either to really perform that role.
I can appreciate that. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you. And thank you again, Robert, Julia, and Michael. I always learn so much from your reports. And I also missed the opportunity to have you in the city council chambers while we're having this conversation. I appreciate the ones that you highlighted. And as you said, there's really a lot in this report. What I want to focus on is a couple that Chief Resch, I thought did a really good job of being of answering the questions that were raised in the recommendations. And so I want to applaud her work at being kind of transparent on what she thought was a good idea and what she didn't think was a good idea at the time. But there were a couple of areas where the chief and OIR group disagreed that I wanted to talk about. And I also wanted to highlight that in recommendation 21, the Bureau's answer was that we're in the process of developing a body-worn camera program. We are no longer and have any interest in body-worn camera programs. And so I would like you to speak to, and I know what you were speaking to. You were speaking to the video that was around Portland State University, an outside video and the PSU officers' body cams as well. And so I know what you were speaking to. And so if you could, because I don't think the chief's response, the former chief's response was actually to the question of the day, right? Which is, how do you get the body cam footage from Portland State University or any other, either private security or a private business when you're conducting an investigation?
Yes and yes. So the whole question of acquisition is something that Rob spoke to and some of the challenges there. But then, and I understand, you know, that the Bureau does not outfit its officers with body-worn camera footage. That being said, I think with the increased presence of cell phone video, with the increased presence of surveillance video for businesses, that more and more of these events are gonna undoubtedly be captured on video. So whether there are body cameras or not, in our view, there ought to be a protocol to instruct the Bureau, before you afford an officer an opportunity to review any video, get a statement from him or her for the same reason that we don't want the delay in obtaining information. And so get that statement. We don't have any problem with after an initial statement is obtained, allowing the officer to see the video and then seeing whether that refreshes their recollection. But we want that pure statement first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I totally agree with that. And I think we have to make sure that that there's no more wiggle room around that initial statement right after the incident, or at least at a minimum before the end of the shift. We've been talking about that for a lot of years. And I'm actually honestly surprised that your report reflects that even though the rule is no longer in the contract, the practice continues to be the same. And so it is my commitment to make sure that we as a council fix that before you do the next review.
I just wanted to add to that, Commissioner Hardesty. Pardon the interruption.
Don't worry.
I think there's, so the rule used to be you had to wait at least 48 hours.
Right.
And now the practice is that you take the statement within 48 hours. So it doesn't go beyond 48 hours, but generally it's somewhere in the 24 to 48 hour window that they're doing the statement. So it's better, but it's.
Yeah, but best practice is right before the end of the shift, right? So.
Right. This recommendation 21 actually came up in the context of the shooting of Mr. Elifritz, because there was a bystander. There were a number of cell phone videos that were immediately uploaded to YouTube. Officers went home. Every one of the shooters reported in his administrative interview, which happened within that 48 hours or very close to that, that he had seen that footage prior to giving a statement. And so that was sort of that it's not to beat the proverbial dead horse about the importance of getting a quick statement, but that case really did highlight one of the challenges. If you let officers leave, relieve them of duty before their shift, relieve them from their shift before they get that statement.
I agree. I will say with your recommendation number 22, I don't think professional service standards division is high enough in the city's food chain to actually accomplish what it is that needs to happen. This needs to be a conversation with leadership at PSU, which means it should be leadership at the city of Portland, at a minimum, including the police chief. But certainly, I would not expect to get they're going to return their call right away if the professional standards division would call the president of Portland State University. And so I think we have an obligation to make sure we take that off their shoulders so that we get the result that we're looking for. And then the last thing before I turn it over to my colleagues, because I could talk all day, but I have one last question that I want to put on the record. I got way too many papers, I can tell you that. Thank you for that report, because that's exactly what it did with me. So I want to talk about the private meeting with the family members. I will just say I can certainly understand the police bureau's reluctance to actually have that meeting, as well as the community meeting, right? Because what I know is the history has been after a officer-involved shooting, the police bureau puts out a statement almost immediately, and the statement is focused on either the criminal history of the person who was just shot, and so we start off in a very adversarial role, acknowledging that somebody's lost their life anyway, right? And so I think unless that internal protocol is changed, so that we are not actually putting out statements that regurgitate someone's history, because I don't believe their history has anything to do with their death. And so I think there needs to be a new protocol developed that says the only information should be the very basics, because no investigation has been done. And I think family members would be more open to having a conversation when they're not seeing their loved ones vilified on the media prior to a full investigation having taken place. I see Michael shaking his head up and down.
I'm just chomping at the bit here, Commissioner, because I couldn't agree more with your point. The other point is that these community meetings need to be carefully crafted. Yes. And I would suggest that this should not just be a bureau lift, that other city entities should be involved and participate and facilitate those kinds of meetings. I'm not sure the Bureau could effectively do it on its own. I think it would take a city-wide effort to come up with some good progressive constructs, but it can be done, and in my view, it should be done.
Excellent. And so I'm going to put OIR group on the spot. My office has reached out because I actually wanted to kind of have a briefing before we got here today, and we weren't able to make that happen. But they'll be reaching out again because I would love your help as we in Portland start rethinking, as we start reimagining what community safety looks like in Portland. It is vital that we have we're able to tap into the expertise that you bring to us on an annual basis. And because you have done more deep dive into the Portland Police Bureau bureaucracy, and I say that kindly, than just about anybody else, it will be vital for you to help us as we continue on this journey to rethink community safety and rethink the role of policing in our community. Because you're being called to respond all over the country now because a whole lot of other communities are having the same conversations. It's important that that I tap into your expertise. So hopefully you will be able to respond to my requests for some one-on-one time as we continue this journey.
Thank you, Commissioner. And of course, we'll take any call. You know how to find us, and we look forward to a more intimate conversation.
Thank you very much. Appreciate all of you. And again, excellent work, lots of good information, and I look forward to seeing the police chief's response as well. Thank you.
Yeah, and if I could just put in a personal note on meeting with families, I've set sort of a personal standard for myself as the mayor and the police commissioner, and the standard I've put into place is I will meet with the families if they would like to meet with me. I have found, honestly, some families do not want that interaction. It's re-traumatizing for them. So I would just say, I'm not sure I like the idea of a mandate, but maybe a mandated offer to the family or some sort of a specific way of engaging to the family. Some families have not wanted to meet early, and then later on, after they've dealt with their hurt and their grief, they have wanted a meeting. Sometimes they want a meeting that isn't just with them. They want a meeting with them and some other folks. So I just want to be a little bit cautious about a one-size-fits-all approach to what is a very personal and traumatizing situation. And I'm not sure we should put the needs or interests of our bureaucracy ahead of the needs or the interests of the family. So I'm certainly open to that discussion and what those protocols might look like. And I'm sure there's other examples from around the nation we could draw from. I know we're on our own Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing had considered referring something to the city council for consideration. I think they missed by a vote or two. So I know this is a hot issue and it's something people want to engage in, but I just wanted to give you that personal note that I know that that I and police chiefs have met, and others, frankly, in the city infrastructure have met with families in the past. And all of us here know Antoinette Edwards, when she was the director of the Office of Violence, she regularly met with families. She served as a really important building block and bridge between the Portland Police Bureau, the city council, and the community. And I know that Nike Green has continued to fill that role. So I would want it to be a broader conversation than just the one we're having here.
And Mayor, I just would add to that. I remember Kendra James' mom, it took her a decade to be able to talk about Kendra James and what happened to her. And I totally agree with you. I think the family has the lead. They have to let us know what they want, as compared to us just having a protocol that we just show up on their doorstep and say, oh, can we talk, right? I absolutely agree with you. I think that one is one that has to be based on what the family needs, not what the city needs.
Yeah, good, exactly right. Thank you.
If I could too, this is Chief Lavelle. We're all in agreement on the family piece. I think that is just fundamentally the right thing to do if the situation warrants it. I know that had come up with PSEP previously, And I know when Fatlow was here, she did meet with some family along with the mayor. And I think it's really the time frame and the mechanics on how it happens should be up to the family as well. But I think, you know, as an organization, as city leaders, we should make ourselves available to the family to help with their healing and understanding of the situation.
Does nobody else have questions? I could go on all day. Well, since nobody's jumped in, I do have one more question. I think that you pointed out that there are some people who excel at doing the reporting after incidents and really actually participates in analyzing what could have happened differently, were there other options available to the officers, whether there was awaiting backup, whether it was calling CERT or the mental health team. But I realized that you said that there were two commanders that basically just kind of did the bare minimal. And I'm curious whether that is a pattern with the same commander or if that's a pattern that is being shared across the Bureau leadership.
You know, we have we've noticed a very wide variety of talent and interest with regard to that particular report. And there are, this is a very multifaceted process that that PPB employs, which is for the most part a positive, but sometimes there are bottlenecks and sometimes there's a little phoning it in. Mm. And, you know, we've become over the years sort of critics of this particular literary product. And I was gratified to see that the chief's response to that, our comment and recommendation about the commander's memo in particular was that, you know, it will be made clear that that's an expectation that the commander addresses, you know, the full and appropriate array of factors that she or he should in their analysis. Training is also an important component. And I think my colleagues would agree that trainings analyses are often very good and have gotten a little better over the years. And when they're not, when they're perfunctory or cookie cutter, we notice.
It stands out, right?
It does. And that's the sign of a healthy, at least that aspect is a healthy part of the internal analysis, because they wouldn't stand out if everybody's phoning it in. And we've certainly seen patterns like that in other police agencies.
So one of the things in your report kind of horrified me, the use of the behavioral health unit to actually interrogate a patient in a hospital bed. I'm happy to see that the Bureau has said that they should modify its protocol, but where was that ever in a protocol that you would be using someone who has been trained in mental health for interrogation of a subject in a hospital, especially around a crime when they're not actually the detective? I mean, and why was that? Because I understand that the person refused to talk to the police. And so we're sitting in the behavioral health unit, a way to get around his request for a lawyer. And is that why they were not indicted?
It was not good in lots of ways, Commissioner. but you're absolutely right. Mr. Peebles had invoked and Miranda applied. He was in custody. He was being treated in a hospital. He had serious injuries from the shooting. He wasn't really in a good position to communicate effectively. And this behavioral health unit team comes in and starts questioning him. The other problem is we don't even know really what they talked about, because again, contrary to investigative protocols, the unit didn't tape record that conversation. So the good thing is that apparently it wasn't used in the prosecution of Peoples, of Mr. Peoples, but the bad thing is it even happened. Mm-hmm. And so we are also gratified that the Bureau recognizes this is inappropriate for BHO to do that. The other real problem is the optics of it all. BHU was created to build bridges with those who are in mental health crises throughout the city. And if there's anything that would certainly damage that bridge building, would be to use BHU in this capacity.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, that one just kind of appalled me. That one stood out with flags all over it. Thank you very much. Oh, and let me ask another question. I mean, I know that part of the investigative process is to collect video evidence. I mean, the police certainly do that when they're prosecuting crime, right? So I'm surprised that they would not be actually doing the same thing when they're investigating an officer shooting by a police officer, right? I mean, just a regular protocol. I've watched enough Law and Order to know that, you know, that they collect all the data that's available. And I've certainly seen that in action as people have been arrested for criminal behavior. And so I guess I'm just surprised that that wouldn't be just a part of what a investigation would entail. And the fact that we have to write it in as standard operating procedures, maybe that's a better question for the chief. But I was just really curious. That's not normal in other policing agencies, is it? To not collect that data, whether it's biological data from a hospital or video data that's available from outside cameras.
That may be a question for the chief, Commissioner Hardesty. We did note a couple things. On the video evidence, we do think that generally the Bureau does a very good job on that. In fact, they've upped their game and they have somebody with a level of expertise. One of the things that is correct is whether it's the more recent Ring videos that everyone, you know, now wants to buy, or more often in businesses, there are videos that are, you know, of ancient vintage from the 80s and 90s. And if you just send a patrol officer to try and download that information, you could run the risk of losing that information or not being able to extract it. So they have an individual on staff who Rob and I had a chance to meet, who has a level of expertise, which is good. There was an issue with regard to an individual who was shot and not killed, in which the medical information that is always valuable to review an officer involved shooting was not recovered. And the initial response from the Bureau was the DA said they didn't need it. But in our view, it shouldn't be the DA that decides whether they need it, because the criminal piece is only a very small piece of the whole review process. So in our view, it should be the Bureau that's making that decision and collecting that information.
So Michael, I should tell you that as of January 1st, 2021, there will be a ban on facial recognition technology in the city of Portland. And so that Ring thing will be a thing of the past, and whatever other schemes people have, that is gonna be private as well as public ban. And so, yes, we are unique. We continue to be unique, but just wanted you to know that will be as of January 1st, 2021.
Got it.
This is Chief Lavelle again. As a general rule, we do try to collect all video when at all possible. We have a few specialized folks in our forensics evidence division that do that type of work. And we do have the person that Michael mentioned who specializes in video collection, and we try to utilize for that purpose.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Again, I am just very grateful for the detailed work that you continue to do, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I just want to take a quick minute, if I could, just to thank Michael, Julie, and Robert from OIR for the hard work putting this report together. This report really does help us look at these OISs and put a different set of eyes on them. We do incorporate a lot of the recommendations that come out of them, and it makes our processes better. There's a lot of people that put a lot of hard work into this with OIR, our professional standards team, our training division, our policy team, and also our investigative branch too. So I just wanted to say thank you. We look forward to continued collaboration, and we want to use your skills and experience to help us be better.
Thank you, Chief.
Commissioner Fritz.
So to that point, I'm confused now because the League of Women Voters testimony says that this is the last OAR report and that no new RFP process is in place to continue their role or select a new one. Could somebody clarify that, please?
I could do that, Mayor. The contract that OIR currently has ends at the end of this year, and we are not going to launch a new process until after the election on November 3rd.
But you will be engaging somebody after that, and why wait until after the election?
Because there is a lot of uncertainty about how we're going to go forward if the ballot measure passes, and it makes it very difficult to attract people to take jobs in IPR or to sign up for contracts when we can't answer questions about what the future will hold. So after the election, we'll have a lot more certainty about what that information could be and should be, and we'll be prepared to make some decisions after that.
So that is of concern to me. We know that should the ballot measure pass, it's not, the system is not going to be operational in the near, right away. Right. So what happens over the next year?
We will hopefully have some information to share with people about what the next steps are. I don't know what the next steps are, so I couldn't answer them today, but I think that we have done some planning and some considering some options, and we're just going to wait until after the election so that we can intelligently answer questions about from potential bidders. Because they may say, well, how long is this going to be in your office? You know, we're entering into a contract with you. Is this going to hold over? You know, there's a lot of things that we don't know. So I think we'll know more after that.
Well, this is one case where I think continuing the contract or extending it for another year with OIR would be appropriate. They've been performing the function since 2012 review of James Chassie case. And I think it's really helpful to have ongoing input from the same company doing the analysis. So I encourage you to consider at least a one-year extension.
We're considering a number of options, and we will do whatever is legal under procurement law.
And for the OIR group, there's a ballot measure that will create a true community oversight board, if you are confused about the conversation that's happening now. That will be fabulous and wonderful and community controlled. And so, but what we know is that it'll be at least 2 years before that board is seated. And there's a lot of work to do between election day and when that board takes their seats. And so we look forward to working with you to continue to improve why we are improving our systems of oversight and accountability. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Commissioner Fritz. I also want to thank the OIR team. I want to thank the auditor for bringing this forward. As I said up front, I think the independent insights and recommendations are incredibly valuable for the entire community. I also want to give a heads up. The OIR group will be hosting a virtual community forum to answer questions about the report on November 6th. That'll be at an IPAC meeting. More information will be forthcoming, that there's another opportunity for the public to participate. And just on a final note, I will say, I think we can all looking under are definitely the most challenging our city has ever faced. The nightly violence and divisive rhetoric infecting our city and our entire nation tests even the strongest and the most resolute amongst us. Our city and our nation are going through a very historic transition period. People are demanding racial justice and fundamental change. And the challenge of creating that change, I think we all agree it's monumental, and this council is all in. Nowhere is that challenge more monumental than in the public safety institutions that we have been discussing today. The challenge of creating that change is going to be in front of us for some time to come. And nowhere is that change more important. When it comes to public safety, this is truly a matter of life or death. The discussion today and the recommendations provided by OIR help move our work forward. And I will be the first to acknowledge we have a lot more work to do. We need new and better responses to people suffering mental health crisis. I was glad that we spent time on that today. We need to reduce the number of interactions with police that end in violence. And at the same time, we're making progress. The police bureau is working hard to implement recommendations from OIR and from across our community. And despite the distance we still need to travel, I believe Portland remains out front or near the front of cities across the United States when it comes to public safety reform. I know my colleagues and I remain committed to doing more and doing it as quickly as possible. Achieving change is going to take time, and it's going to take fundamentally different tactics. And yes, it will also take resources. It will take patience, and the Portland Police Bureau has a critical role to play. And so we're going to keep pushing to the Portland Police Bureau to live up to that critical role. This work is fundamental. The need to respond to our community's changing needs is essential. And I want to thank everybody for your contributions today. Is there any other business on this item? Commissioner Ryan, you have your hand up.
Yes, thank you. It's great to be in this conversation. I am definitely feeling extremely new at this moment. But thank you, Michael, Robert, and Julie. That was a really, was a great report to listen to. I love audits, and so I really just have an audit process question. I know when I've been involved in a leadership position with an audit, and there's something on there that says, I agree, but then the current practice hasn't been implemented. And then if that happens over time, that becomes a growing concern. So what I haven't done my homework, and I don't know what the previous reports had, and I would love to know like how many of these statements, recommendations made were repetitive from the past. And then you always want to see when they move from agree to current practice or, you know, disagree to agree to current practice. Am I even saying anything that makes any sense, first of all? And then are there past reports that I can look at that would show me that pattern? And I was picking up on some of that when I was listening to the dialogue, but again, I haven't done my homework. So.
Commissioner Ryan, it's an important piece of any auditing, sort of the longitudinal tracking of recommendations and the degree to which they're implemented. And I have to say that sometimes it takes a while, and sometimes we have to up the game with regard to our recommendations before they actually impact what's going on with regard to practice. So for example, a few years ago, we recommended that sergeants behave as sergeants, and we recommended some training to first level supervisors to ensure that they don't take over the tactical role, but instead supervise officers to do that. The training didn't seem to be having an impact in the behavior of sergeants. So then we upped it to setting out a policy that advised sergeants to that effect, and that sergeants would be held accountable if they didn't. And that just got enacted by the Bureau. So sometimes, and the problem is sometimes we're looking at cases that they couldn't have adopted the recommendations because the cases have already happened. So sometimes that time lag takes a while, but we are watching it. And we are also to the degree we will continue thinking of other ways to better report that back. That may be a role for example, the Citizen Review Commission, to the degree they continue to be part of the process, are supposed to report back on recommendations to change policy. And maybe we can work with them to ensure that that happens.
That was helpful to listen to. And I appreciate it. I think it was you, Julie, that mentioned there are two ways to look at this, where we're a violation of policy. And then the second one was, I think, where can we do better next time? And I really appreciated listening to what you explained is that the culture here is not as defensive, perhaps, as some of your clients, if you will. And I really get used to me saying this. I believe practice eats policy for lunch any day. So that number two was more interesting to me than actually number one. And so anyway, thank you for the presentation. I promise to dig in and try to find those longitudinal connections. And I look forward to Madam Auditor helping me perhaps with that as well. So thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Ryan. Anybody else for the good of the order? Great, thank you. This is a report. Commissioner Daly.
I suppose I could just save these for closing remarks, but I wanted to participate a little bit so people knew that I was here. I just want to thank you for the report. This is always a really challenging and difficult report to look at, especially for those of us who have lost friends, family, and community members to in police shootings. So I have just been listening and absorbing all the information today, and will say that I'm very hopeful for Portland Street Response and anxious to see it launched, because we clearly are still not adequately serving individuals experiencing mental health crises. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Udaly. Very good. I'll entertain a motion.
So moved. To accept the report.
Second.
We have a motion from Commissioner Hardesty, second from Commissioner Udaly. Please call the roll, Cleland.
Hardesty.
Again, thank you all very much for your very detailed work. It is always a pleasure to have this kind of in-depth conversation about policy and how we make it better. One thing I know you've been recommending for ever since you started doing this is a change in the police review board. Unfortunately, that's one of those things that's on the list that, you know, won't change in our lifetime unless we change how we do oversight of policing, and we are on path to do that. I want to, again, thank you for your time, thank you for your expertise, and thank you for your kindness. You have built really strong relationships with community-based organizations who don't trust government, don't trust the police, and don't normally trust certified smart people, but you've worked hard to make sure that you've been open to community concerns and dialogue. And I am grateful for that work, and I look forward to us continuing the work to make Portland a safer, more just city. I vote aye.
You, Daly.
Well, I wanna thank OAR for the report. I think sometimes Portlanders resent outsiders. In this instance, I feel like the distance you have brings a level of objectivity to this work that we might not get if this work was being done directly in the community. And I just find your perspective really helpful. Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty, for the conversation today. I didn't really need to ask many questions because you asked all of them, which is fantastic. I want to thank the auditor for her ongoing work to promote accountability, and just say I'm thankful to have colleagues and be on a council that's so willing to tackle these really challenging and urgent issues. So happy to vote aye.
Fritz.
Thank you very much for your report. I've been present for everyone that you've given, and this is my last one. So I want to say for over the years that you've done a fantastic job, and as was noted, you've done it in a way that engages the community, that is kind, and which is very objective and helpful. So I, for one, hope that there is a way to continue the contract so that we can get your expertise. And it's good to know that you have been talking with community as well. I'm always disappointed when something like this doesn't have public comment due to the way that it's brought to council. So we did get some emailed comments, and I'm sure we'll get more after the folks have watched this. And again, thank you to the diligent folks in the community who are continuing to strive with us to improve the outcomes. Aye.
Ryan.
Yes, I concur with all my colleagues, and I appreciated this presentation. And I do hope that I'll see all of you again, and make sure when you come here, you spend a lot of money. Anyway, I vote aye.
Wheeler.
Thank you again, everybody, for your support on this, the great work of OIR. Thank you, Madam Auditor, for bringing this forward, you and your team. I always appreciate these reports, and today was no exception. Thanks, and we'll see you again soon, we hope. Keelan, can you confirm that is our agenda for this afternoon?
Yes.
All right. Thank you, everybody. This was a good day for the Portland City Council. We are adjourned.
Thanks, everybody. Good to see you all.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.